Nero saw the reproach and redoubled his hate. Pressed by Agrippina's menaces, having no charge against his brother and not daring openly to order his murder, he meditated a secret device and directed poison to be prepared through the agency of Julius Pollio, tribune of one of the Praetorian cohorts, who had in his custody a woman under sentence for poisoning, Locasta by name, with a vast reputation for crime. Roman senator and historian Tacitus was not a big fan of his older contemporary, Nero, the first century Roman emperor. Nero is notorious for things he did and things he probably did not do. Did he really set the fire that burned much of Rome? Did he have his own brother and mother killed? Why is his name a household word nearly 2,000 years after just 14 years of being emperor? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Our guest is Margaret George, the author of best-selling historical novels, the next of which will be about Nero.
And welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
We've talked to you in the past about some of your work on Helen of Troy or Cleopatra, figures like that. What drew you to this figure of Nero in particular?
Well, I had wanted to do a Roman emperor ever since I did a little bit about Julius Caesar, you know, in the Cleopatra book. But he just seemed to me to be the emperor that all roads led to, in a way. When you think about an emperor, you think about Nero, and everybody knew who he was. If you went out to West Town and you said, "Who's Nero?" they would all know. Well, most people would.
Well, they would know he fiddled while Rome burned, a sort of tagline that isn't even necessarily true.
Or they'd have some vague notion of notoriety, perhaps.
Yes, and I just thought also he's so visual, you know. I mean, that's why they call him Hollywood's favorite emperor. And, of course, those performances by Peter Ustinov, and they just stick with you. But anyway, I just was fascinated with him because of all the contradictions in him. You know, the whole artistic thing and then the whole, you know, weird. Well, one historian called him the cavorting tyrant.
Well, that would apply to a lot of them.
Yes,
but he had some
right.
other things that they seem
that's
not
right.
to have. When you wrote your autobiographical, I'll call it, novel about Henry VIII, you were the first to portray him in a positive light. Are you thinking you can pull that off with Nero?
Oh, it's much more of a challenge, but I'm going to try. Yeah, that's the thing. I think it's a more of an uphill battle. But I do think there's good things about him, and apparently there were a number of historians that wrote favorable things about him, but we've lost those. We know that because Josephus talks about it. He says, well, they're unfavorable and they're favorable, and so I'm not going to quote them because everybody knows them. And then he goes on and gives his little summary. But, of course, the favorable ones are gone, and you can kind of interpret what the other three say, and you can kind of use other documentation on the side to try to reconstruct what were the good things that we're missing.
I wanted to read you a list of adjectives that's currently on the RomanEmpire.net site about Nero. First of all, talking about what he looked like and smelled like, but then it lists this strange mix of paradoxes. Artistic, sporting, brutal, weak, sensual, erratic, extravagant, sadistic, bisexual, and later in life almost certainly deranged.
Well, I think they're probably all true, except I don't know about the deranged one.
I would contest
deranged. But I think the others, very interesting because you don't think of him as being athletic, but actually apparently he was a very good wrestler, and he built this gymnasium. And he would go down and exercise in the gymnasium, you know, with all the other people. And his big deal was chariot racing. And we tend to think of that as, you know, not as difficult as I guess it was, because he ended up driving a 10-horse chariot. And that really took a lot of skill, so no wonder he fell out.
He fell out but still won.
Because he was ahead when he fell out. Of course, as an emperor, he couldn't really be able to compete against people. And I think he was a kind of denial on his part that people were letting him win. with his poetry, his music, or whatever, that the emperor couldn't not win, but he would get all nervous about his performances. But the chariot racing was dear to his heart. So, and what else were some of the other ones that were?
Artistic, sporting, brutal, weak, sensual, erratic, extravagant, sadistic, and bisexual.
So we've done brutal. We've done athletic and artistic.
We touched on it.
How about sensual?
Sensual. Yes, I think so. All of his luxuries, and then weak and brutal. You know, they say he did not like killing. That he wanted to ban the gladiatorial contests because they were too cruel. But they say he only killed when he was frightened. Unfortunately, he was easy to frighten. So, I mean, that's what I mean. These things are true, but there are explanations for how they can both exist at the same time like that.
Yeah, well, that's true of a lot of people. It's just that they're more extreme with Nero, apparently. So you've mentioned three sources, three more or less contemporary sources of information about Nero, people who were younger when he was emperor, but enough to know some of what was going on. And who are they?
Well, not really. Tacitus wrote 50 years after his reign. He was about 10, about 10 years difference. And then Suetonius is also writing about 50 years afterwards. And then Dio Cassius, that's the last one that we only have a medieval summary of some of his stuff. It's not even all there. That's 150 years afterwards. So although he adds some things, and especially the last 2 years of Nero's life, which is maybe when the deranged part comes in, we're missing Tacitus's story about it. And that's a real gap, because then you have to rely only on Suetonius and Dio.
Why was it missing?
We don't know. It's just gone. And there's some other ones of his books that are just gone. So it stops right when you get to the really part, the juicy part, the part where he goes off to Greece to compete in all these athletic contests. And when they revolt against him, and when he commits suicide, and how he fell from power, and all that's missing.
And do we know of the three sources that are there, do we know whether there were particular biases, axes to grind, that would make their account suspect?
Yeah, I think that people say that Tacitus is the greatest of the Roman historians, but because he was very conservative and he has his own biases, and because he writes in a certain manner that seems to be giving you the facts, but in fact it can be interpreted also through his biases, you have to be careful with taking everything he says for absolute truth. Now, Suetonius, he's just a grab bag of a lot of, records. He puts in every bit of gossip, every bit of everything, which is good because he's preserved it for us. He hasn't decided which is right and which is wrong. There's another reason you get these contradictions. And he had access to things in the Roman archives. Dio, he's further removed, we know they used sources, but those sources are lost. So scholars have spent a lot of time trying to reconstruct, what part of Tacitus relies on this and what part of Dio relies on this, kind of trying to reconstruct these things that are missing. It's really kind of shocking how much is missing of a lot of things in the ancient world that we think we know all these things, but we have so little really to compare and contrast with it.
Sometimes I wonder that we have so much, though, given that it's 2,000 years or more have passed. One thing about Tacitus is that you really feel as if you're there. I mean, he seems to know things that only one or two people could have known, conversations and feelings and thoughts.
So perhaps those are from those lost memoirs. And we know that Nero's mother, Agrippina, wrote an autobiography, and it's missing.
Oh, boy, that would be a colorful one.
And apparently she pulled no punches in it. She didn't mind naming names and confessing to all kinds of stuff, and that's gone.
It intrigues me, when this happens. I'm not sure there's any way of knowing, but, in Egypt, for example, when a pharaoh fell from favor, they would knock down all of his or her statues and all kind of like Hatshepsut, they'd erase every mention of her. You almost wonder if that somebody didn't systematically go through the libraries in Rome at some point and purge anything that seemed to have to do with one point of view or another.
Maybe they did. That's another thing we'd really like to know. I know that they did overthrow Nero's statue, so we have very few contemporary portraits of Nero that survived. We have a lot of ones from the Baroque and Renaissance era because they loved sculpting him because they said if anybody was Baroque, it was Nero with all his curls and all this. But, you know, some of those things always survive and some of them have, but they're not very plentiful.
Well, it's funny then how sure of themselves so many encyclopedia-type articles, whether in print or online, will sound where they'll say, as in this one, Nero was fair-haired with weak blue eyes, a fat neck, a pot belly, and a body which smelt and was covered with spots. So I guess my question to you after you've looked into the different sources and so on, how much of that can we say, yes, that is fact, and how much of that is just sort of a reconstruction and a guess based on rumors?
Well, I think you can look at his portraits, and you can certainly see that he had a thick neck. And you can see him changing, too, because he became emperor when he was really young. In fact, he was not even quite 17. He was a few months, so he was only 16. And so the coins, which some of them are pretty accurate portraits, show this kind of thin neck, you know, young, good-looking guy. And then he gets progressively more Nero-like until he's, you know, the big neck. And so I think that part, you have a visual you can verify with. As for the spots and the bad odor, I don't know how we would do that. But I didn't, you know, and his being blonde, that's interesting because I think I read somewhere also that one of the other sources is that he has shaved his beard for the first time. It was red or reddish, so that would kind of confirm that his hair must have been light, I'm guessing.
Which is counter to what we expect, isn't it?
Right, right. And his eyes, I think he was supposed to be short-sighted, and he used this emerald to look through.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what do we know for a fact about when he was born and the family that he came from?
He was born, we do know, at December 15th, the year 37 A.D., and he was supposedly... Then you get into the myths. And outside of Rome and what's now Anzio, it's about, I think, about 40 miles away from Rome. It's on the seacoast. And supposedly, as he was born, the rising sun struck his, and they held him up, and that meant he was meant for great things. But he came from a very murderous family background. He was the great-grandson of Mark Antony. He was the great-great-grandson of Augustus, so he had this, you know, fancy pedigree. You couldn't get much better than that. And as his reign went on, more and more of the direct descendants of Augustus were eliminated, so that by the time Nero died, there weren't any left. But at the time he was born, there were a number of them. So they would not have foreseen that he would become emperor. His mother was the ambitious Agrippina the Younger, who was the daughter of Agrippina the Elder, who was the daughter of Augustus's daughter, Julia. But her husband was this great guy, Germanicus, who was this handsome soldier that was this hero, and probably had ever become emperor, he might not have been as good as people imagined him to be, but there was this tremendous Germanicus worship. And so she had all this prestige by being his daughter. On the other side, he came from a family that the last name was Ethobarbus, and they were kind of, you know, they were always in trouble. They were always brawling. They were always doing bad stuff. But also through that line was the Mark Antony line. And so he had a good background, but his father said when he was born, you know, anything born of me and Agrippina, it would be a monster, it would be terrible, or it would be better that he wasn't born, something to that effect. So the characters of his parents were not exactly sterling.
Was he not the youngest person to become emperor?
I think he was.
And how did that come about?
Well, it came about by his mother's machinations. His mother, Agrippina, was, as soon as the Emperor Claudius needed a new wife, because we won't go into the Messalina business, but anyway, Claudius was an emperor in search of a wife, and Agrippina had Nero. He was an only child, and she thought this is her great opportunity, so she got Claudius to marry her, even though he was her uncle, and it was forbidden by Roman law, but they got around that, and then she got Claudius to adopt Nero and make him his adopted son, and that Nero was older than Claudius's natural son, Britannicus. So Agrippina waited until Nero was old enough that he had assumed, you know, done the manly toga and become an adult, while Britannicus was still a child, and figured now's the time to get rid of Claudius before Britannicus gets old enough to take over the throne. So she, you know, poisoned him with the mushrooms.
Claudius.
Poisoned mushrooms.
So and if Agrippina poisoned Claudius,
yes.
Then why was she not caught?
Oh yes. Wow.
Well, because it was, she did it very cleverly. I mean, no one could ever prove it. So again, there you get the historical gossip. The gossip was, and I think it was in Tacitus, but probably in Suetonius and Dio as well, that she had his special mushrooms all, you know, coated with poison, and she fed him these mushrooms. And then when he didn't die soon enough, the physician was in on it and gave him, tickled his throat. But the throat was with a feather, was coated with poison, and then he expired. So therefore, now you have Nero, who's 16. She had everything all set up. She kept the palace closed and didn't announce that Claudius was dead till she could get the Praetorian Guard to, you know, go along with this and hail Nero.
The guard that took care of the emperor,
yes,
personally.
Yes, and you had to have the proclamation of the Praetorian Guard really to be emperor now, because they had made Claudius emperor. So she masterminded all of this.
So now you have Claudius's, the natural son, to take care of.
Yes, you've got to get rid of him too, because, well, he didn't have to at first because he was still young, but obviously people were going to question why, you know, what about Britannicus? And he would always be the focus of an alternative party. As long as you have another heir to the throne, there's always going to be disaffected people around that person wanting to get rid of you. So therefore, you've got to get rid of the alternative option. And that was done very cleverly, too, with the poison. And then passed off as an epileptic fit, although it was obvious that he had been murdered because they had the funeral pyre all ready for him. I mean, you have him for dinner, and he dies at the table, and then you conveniently have this funeral pyre, you know, a few hundred yards away, just ready. I think it's kind of suspicious.
Just like that's the passage that we opened with, is, yeah, referring to the plot against, yeah, young Britannicus.
And do we know how much Nero was involved in that plot along with his mother, including the plot to get the throne? I mean, he would have been a young teenager as she was marrying Claudius. And
we don't really know what his feelings were, how much he was really under his mother's thumb until he decided he didn't want to be under,
right,
his mother's thumb. How much he was aware of it, nobody really knows. Certainly the murder of Britannicus was apparently green-lighted not only by Agrippina, who did it, but the noble Seneca and this other man, Burrus, the Praetorian guardman. So, you know, you get philosophers involved with poisoning people. It's a very colorful time, not at all like ours. So, yeah, that's a question, is how much did he know? And I've always felt that because so many people were killed to make him emperor, he really is like the guy who had to become an insurance agent and work for the family company when he really wanted to be an artist. And in Nero's case, he had to be emperor because, you know, there had been so many sacrifices and so many strings pulled to make him emperor. Besides, it had a lot more perks than being an insurance agent. So so he stuck with being an emperor, but his real desire was this artist side of him, which he had to suppress for a long time.
I can just hear Agrippina, like many a more contemporary parent, saying, look, I did all of this for you.
I did all of this for
you.
That's right.
But it is interesting to what extent somebody controls their destiny if they inherit, mm-hmm, something that's already so filled with corruption and evil. I'm even thinking, to put it in a contemporary term, in terms of North Korea's leader,
yeah,
inheriting from his father a certain way of governing and sort of odd combination of factors.
Well, there was a long tradition of that sort of thing in Rome by then.
Yes, and I've always thought that his artistic thing was actually his escape. I mean, if you want to see him in a more favorable light, and maybe that's what some of the vanished histories did, is his only escape from all of that was to retreat into his artistry. where he would act and he and write poetry and sing, and that's a whole different world. And maybe he saw it as not corrupt. He didn't understand that. He didn't want to think that that too was fixed and that he would always win. But I think he took his, it was, you know, perhaps that was the only world he saw was pure and untainted.
You are so sympathetic.
I'm so sympathetic.
Well, we don't have that autobiography from his mother, but I sure wish we did.
Oh, do I ever. Oh, golly.
Well, now that we have gotten Nero emperor, we'll see how it plays out between him and his mother, Agrippina, and also how he behaves when he is the head of state. We'll return shortly. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Margaret George, who is researching and writing about the Emperor Nero, who became the Emperor of Rome at the age of 17, largely through the machinations of his mother, Agrippina. And once he becomes emperor, what's the relationship between Nero and his mother?
Well, in the beginning, her dreams had come true because she was in complete control, which is really what she wanted to be. And she thought he would be this puppet, you know, that she had, he had meekly done everything she said, and now she was in power. And she thought she would kind of share the ruling with him. So she, you know, appointed all of his appointed advisors. She wanted, she had herself depicted on coins with him. She wouldn't let him do his artistry or do his sports. And so for about a couple of years, you know, things were rather smooth. And then he began to, like a teenager, he was just a teenager.
It just happened to be the emperor.
She also didn't understand that she had given him supreme power, and now her creature did have supreme power. He was the emperor. He was not the emperor because of her. He was now the emperor. The training wheels were gone. And he could do what he wanted. So he first thing is he fell in love with this ex-slave girl who actually stayed his faithful friend to the to his last days. But she was a freed woman and quite a wealthy ex-slave. But anyway, he took up with her, and Agrippina didn't care for that. And that was, you know, the beginning of him ignoring her, Agrippina, and not wanting to share his throne with her. She would try to come up and sit with him when he was judging things.
Which would have been kind of a breach of etiquette anyway, wouldn't it, for a woman to be there?
So Seneca, at one point, she wanted to receive these foreign envoys with him, and she was coming to join him. And so it was Seneca who got Nero to come down from the throne and take her hand and take her to her seat. So he was showing deference, but he was also showing, you're not getting up here with me.
She had her place.
And so she became more and more, the more he tried to cut off her power. He eventually had her move out of the palace and back to the place, you know, at Anzio, where he had been born. The more she frantically would start off more plots and everything to try to control him. So at that point, at what point he decided that there just wasn't room for two of them, I don't know.
It would be nice to have some of the dialogue between them as all that was unfolding.
And when, you know, when did he come to this decision, and how hard was it to come to that decision? Are you know, who, did anyone put it into his head? There's all the things that we wish we knew and that give lots of scope for a novelist to make up.
I was going to say, you know, for somebody who also wrote about Mary Queen of Scots and, you know, family members executing other family members, this seems to be a kind of a theme in your writing, Margaret.
The people that I choose. So he hit upon this idea, and probably with the advice, it said good old Seneca was in on it again, that, okay, he couldn't, no more poison. I mean, you know, we've done, there's Claudius and there's Britannicus. We don't want to start, the pattern is just getting too obvious. And she couldn't be attacked and cut down with swords or whatever. That's too public. So how about an accident? And what kind of an accident could we have?
Well, poison has already been
Poison's been done. So he thought about an accident at sea, because nobody could ever prove that it wasn't an accident. And he had watched these performances in the arena in which they had these ships that collapsed and they let out animals and gladiators. And he thought, he would have this ship built. And she would go out for this cruise and just never return, and it would be very sad. And then he could mourn her and set up temples to her and so on. And he got she had dismissed one of his tutors back when he was little, and it turned out this man was now the head of the fleet, the Roman fleet. And so he got him, who probably had a huge grudge against mm-hmm. Agrippina, to construct this boat that was supposed to collapse. But Agrippina was suspicious, and with good reason, because she was such a master at offing people. She knew right. She knew what someone might, and they had been kind of estranged. So he invited her to come down and visit him at this palace in the Bay of Naples, and she came, but she didn't want to ride on this. He sent a ship to bring her down, but she didn't want to ride on that ship, and so she came by land, and they had a wonderful dinner together. Supposedly, her suspicions were lulled because she thought the ship she came down on was going to be where they would do something to her. But now she was safe and sound there, and nothing was going to happen to her. And Nero was so sweet and so nice, and they bid each other good night. And then she got on this rigged boat to be taken to her villa, which was across the bay. Like, say, that Nero was here and she was across the bay. And unfortunately, it was a calm night, which wasn't very good for a shipwreck. So the boat set off, and halfway across the bay, the plan was executed, except that the part that collapsed killed the guard that was with Agrippina, but not Agrippina, and not Agrippina's companion. Furthermore, only half of the ship's crew was in on it. So the half that wasn't kept trying to right the ship and fix the ship. Oops.
That would at least make it look more convincing.
Make it look more convincing. And then Agrippina's companion yelled out, "Help, help, I am the empress. I am the empress mother." And she was immediately beaten to death. So then Agrippina figured, I don't know why the woman, why would she yell out, "I'm the empress"?
Maybe she was asked to
Maybe
do so.
Maybe she was asked to do so.
Yeah, like, could be yet another little trick.
Have someone else taste those mushrooms.
Yes. So Agrippina jumped overboard. And even though she was 43 years old, she'd drunk and eaten a lot at this banquet, and her arm had been injured in the fall of the wood. She managed to swim to shore, and she realized that what had happened, and that Nero was going to hear that she hadn't been killed. So she thought and thought, "What shall I do? What shall I do?" And she went back to her villa and decided she had to pretend that she thought it was an accident, and send the emperor word that, a terrible accident has happened. By the kindness of the gods, I have survived. But please, don't come to see me now. I need to rest. I'm resting up. So and then she sent this messenger to give this message. So meanwhile, I guess Nero had heard the thing had gone awry. And when the messenger came, he pretended that the messenger had come to assassinate him, and that a knife had dropped out of his toga. And so he immediately sent someone to just go and finish her off. So he sent soldiers off to her villa, where they broke in. And she was deserted by everybody. All her servants had gone away and her soldiers. And so true to her, the whole family was very histrionic. And she said, "Strike the womb that bore your emperor."
That's always a good deflector shield.
She was stabbed.
And I gather there wasn't a whole lot of opposition to doing away with her?
No, because everybody hated her.
Well, yeah. So what spin was put on it, though, in terms of Nero, that these were some bandits who had broken in? Or, in other words, how did he wash his hands of it?
Oh, he had to say that a terrible plot against him had been foiled and that she had to be executed because she had tried to kill him, and she was
Oh, so
dangerous.
He was up front about it.
He was up front about it.
He was behind her execution.
He was behind her execution because it was a terrible thing, but he had to do away with her.
And he was above any court of law. There were no you know, you didn't have to go through any due process
No. And also the Senate was so servile at this point that they issued thanksgivings for his delivery. And they said, you know, her birthday forever after was a day of bad omen. And so they just rolled over, you know. They just said, oh, we're so glad you were saved. It's just wonderful.
So he has virtually no opposition as emperor now. Doesn't have to deal with his mother, doesn't have to deal with the Senate.
Right.
What kind of agenda does he have?
Now he can do what he wants to do. He can race his chariots and he can sing. And immediately, as soon as his mother was gone, this whole thing burst out. And at first his advisor said, oh, don't do it in public. Oh, no. Do it private performances.
Now, is this because he was no good or because it was unseemly for the emperor to stoop to entertainment?
I think the latter. Apparently, he was actually better than history assumes that he must have been terrible. But apparently, he actually was pretty good and certainly not laughably bad. But it was just not seemly. It was considered very un-Roman. It was shocking to the aristocracy. It was horribly Greek, for one thing. It was effeminate. It was Greek. It was degenerate. And so they said, well, you know, why don't you just give these private performances in your palace? And that satisfied him for a while. But, you know, if you've got the hankering to be on the big stage. And he did his chariot racing in his private gardens. But, you know, that didn't satisfy him for very long. And pretty soon he decreed a big festival for the whole city. Now, the common people really liked him. They liked the extravagances and the chariot racings and the big shows he put on. And he was very solicitous of their grain supply, the free supply they got. But the aristocrats were just horrified. And I've heard analogies, but they can't really be quite the same. They said, imagine the American president mud wrestling or the queen or something. But I don't think
we've come close.
I don't think there's really any analogy to it. Not even going on American Idol, although that would be very embarrassing if the president went on American Idol.
Is it true that some of these performances that he would give were really long and that people would pretend to be dead so they could get taken out?
That's another thing that is part of the lore of Nero. They were really long. Whether people actually had to pretend to be dead or whether people actually gave birth to children, I don't know if that's true. Supposedly the future emperor Vespasian went to sleep in one of them and had to be prodded. But, you know, I would imagine that maybe the people couldn't leave or maybe they didn't dare to leave because, after all, they were getting to be more and more informers so that they would report to the emperor so-and-so left. Now, if you were a common person, I don't know how they would ever know who you were. If you were just a regular bread baker,
how was Nero when it came to Christians?
Oh, Nero and the Christians. There have been much ink spilled on that because that has to do with the fire of Rome. But there's also was a rumor that one of his wives, Poppaea, was a secret Christian. But we know she was, or that she was a Jewish convert. And did he even think about the Christians, really? I mean, or was it just a political thing that he needed a scapegoat? When people kept blaming him for the great fire, he needed somebody to say, they did it. And there really was some thought. I mean, this has been much later. Again, you have to be careful of interpretations that didn't occur to anybody for 2,000 years until then and didn't occur at all to the contemporaries. But there was a report, and I think this is in Tacitus, where they said that people were hindered from fighting the fire. And there were actually people throwing things in the fire to make it burn brighter and more fiercely. And one interpretation is that how the Christians got mixed up with being blamed is that they thought it was the second coming and they were because of the world ending in flames and they were really at that point, like 64 AD, they were still expecting Jesus to come back. They think this was going to be immediate, you know, and that they were helping things along. Now, that may be a really modern thing that wouldn't have occurred to anybody at the time. It's not that far-fetched, but who were these people? On the other hand, they say they could just be looters. They could just be, you know, people who were taking advantage of the fire, people who hated their neighbor's house. They want to see it burned down. You just don't know. It's probably maybe people that do help out when fires are raging.
So did he get into persecutions of Christians?
He certainly did. And that's another thing. It's told only in relation to this one thing. It's interestingly, not in the Christian stories of martyrdom, which you would expect it to be. It's never mentioned in any of the church fathers or any of the stories of the martyrs, but it is in Tacitus and in quite detail. And he's the only one who says, we don't know who started the fire. Some people say it was Nero, and other people say, well, we don't know. But yes, he does say that the Christians were, they decided to blame the Christians. And he said a sect despised because of their hatred for mankind, which is also weird. People have tried and tried to interpret what that means, except if it means they didn't worship the emperor. They weren't part of the mm-hmm. civic religion of Rome, which was considered very unpatriotic. And they said some of them, they said they confessed not just to arson, but also to being a Christian. And so they said, so they did confess to arson, some of them, and then they named some other Christians.
Of course, we don't know what the terms of the interrogation were.
We don't know. We don't know.
Could have been a little painful in the
interrogation. No, we just don't know. And also, that was the age in which there was a lot of people wanting to be martyrs. So, you know, the impulse, like, you know, this is my opportunity, I'm going to be martyred. But if you have that mentality... So anyway, but he did, yeah. There was, and ironically, these persecutions took place in what's now the area of the Vatican, because that's where his racetrack was, and his private gardens were the Vatican racetracks. So that actually took place right near where the modern St. Peter's is. We don't know how many. We don't know.
Do we know whether, in addition to having the freedom to pursue his arts and chariot racing, he also had an agenda to expand the empire, to conquer, to build?
No. In fact, there are some good things in his column. He was not interested in expanding the empire. He was very peaceable. And his two big overseas things that happened when he was emperor was that he settled a big dispute with Parthia. Rome was always having problems with Parthia, and he managed to do this through diplomatic means.
This was, what, over between, what, the Caspian and the Black Sea?
Yeah, it's over there near modern Iraq and Iran. And Armenia was always this kind of this buffer state, and the crown would go back and forth between a Roman puppet and a Parthian puppet. And finally, he was able to negotiate something, get back the eagles. The legionary standards.
Yeah.
And then this king of Armenia came to Rome with a great retinue, and he received his crown from Nero, and there was lots of rejoicing. And that peace held for 50 years. So that was a great achievement. He closed the doors of the Temple of Janus, but meant there was no war. Now, the thing in Britain, the big revolt in Britain, the Queen Boudica, supposedly Nero actually thought about just letting Britain go. It just wasn't worth hanging on to. They didn't really get much out of it. But because Claudius had conquered it, his predecessor, and you know, he felt it was disrespectful to Claudius's memory. So the Romans did put down that rebellion, and it was Nero who wanted to install a governor there that would be lenient. There was a feeling that, oh, you've got to install a really tough guy and beat the heck out of these people, punish them, get a really tough line guy in there to show them who's boss. But Nero appointed a very conciliatory governor who smoothed things out and actually ended up dying there and was buried there. There's a tomb. So he was not a soldier type guy, and he didn't really want military action to expand the empire.
How proactive was he in the rebuilding of Rome after the fire?
Oh, very much so. First of all, he wasn't even in Rome when the fire started, so he couldn't have really been singing about Troy while it was going on.
Dispel that one in a hurry.
Yeah.
Too bad, because it's a nice story.
It's a nice story. He undoubtedly did have a poem about the fall of Troy, but we don't know where he performed it. But he came back to Rome, and he really was very generous. He set up these relief stations in his own palace grounds. He gave them a lot of, you know, the food stores. And then he started with this urban planning to try to make the city fireproof. And he had a lot of regulations, like the streets have to be so-and-so wide, no more narrow streets. The houses have to be brick. They have to have space between the walls. And I recently saw a Nero wall, a firebreak wall, when I was in Rome last time. They pointed it out. It was down actually in the lower part of a church, but it went down to the Nero era, and they said they knew it was a Nero era because there was that yard between the two walls. And people complained, of course, because people always complain. And they said, well, but the old streets were shady, and they met overhead, and these big old wide streets are so hot, and we don't like it.
Not as hot as when the city's burning.
But, yeah, he really did a good job on that.
Well, we'll find out how it all unraveled and the downfall of Nero right after this. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest this hour is Margaret George, and we are talking about the first century Roman Emperor Nero, a very colorful figure, to say the least. Well, we've established that he's killed off his mother, his stepbrother, and all kinds of other things have happened. Rome has burned. Tell us what takes us from the Great Fire of Rome through to Nero's suicide. What is it that goes wrong?
Yeah, there's only 4 years in between that. And the last two, when things really are exploding, unfortunately we lose Tacitus for those. But so after that, Nero really embarked upon his singing career.
Meanwhile, back on American Idol.
And what he did, he really began to neglect his duties as emperor. First of all, there was also in 65, right after the fire of Rome, there was a huge conspiracy against him called the Pisonian Conspiracy, in which they wanted to, well, get rid of him. And it involved a very large number of people, and some of them he was just shocked about because they were his, some of them he thought were his nearest and dearest. There was Seneca, for one thing. There were people he trusted. It was really far-reaching, and it was unraveled really kind of by just a fluke because the person leading it talked too much in front of his slave.
Oh.
And the slave realized what was going on and thought, and his wife said to him, look, you got to go tell the emperor because everybody in this house has heard this, and if you don't tell it, someone else will, and then they're going to think you're part of the plot. So he went to Nero, and he told him what was going on. So that plot completely failed, but I think it really disillusioned Nero. I mean, it was like he really had been, I hate to say, kind of a jolly character up until then, but somewhat trusting in a way. And now this was like he couldn't trust anybody. You know, just couldn't trust anybody. And then his wife died, his beloved Poppaea, and his daughter had died. He had had an infant daughter. And I think he just kind of, maybe that came close to making him, if he was deranged, it's because after that he became kind of unhinged. And he decided he was going to go to Greece and compete in all of the athletic contests and singing contests and music and poetry and so on, because he loved Greece. He just had this thing about Greece.
Is it true that they were in that more eastern part of the empire, that he was really just more adored anyway?
Yes, he was very popular there. It was kind of an echo of his ancestor Mark Antony, who was really kind of went oriental, went eastern, was not very Roman. It was almost like a replay of that. So he just left Rome. And he left Rome in the hands of his freedmen to take over. Went over there and spent 18 months going around, you know, competing in all these things. And meanwhile, Rome was kind of falling apart, and they were starting to have rebellions in Gaul. And he just, you know, he couldn't seem to understand that he was the emperor he needed to be in Rome. And finally, the freedmen came over to Greece and said, "Look, you have to get home. Things are just going to pot." He meanwhile had freed Greece from the yoke of Rome because they were so noble and they had true democracy and all, because he wasn't real big on democracy, but he idolized the classical Greeks. He came back, and at that point it was almost too late. I mean, meanwhile you had generals in Spain, you had Galba in Spain, you had uprisings in Rome itself, and then the worst thing is that the Praetorian Guard just had enough, and they deserted him. But it came to an end fairly quickly because I think he came back to Rome, say, around April or March or April. And by June, early June, he was dead.
And the suicide, was that because he knew they were coming after him?
Yes. It was very elaborate in a sense. He supposedly had all these ideas. He was going to go to Egypt. He wanted to live as a private citizen. And he wanted to go down to Ostia and leave from there. And people think that his Praetorian Guard and even his freedmen, who he went to his house and committed suicide, were in on it and really steered him away, told him that the Praetorian Guard had defected before they had, and told him his only hope was to go and hide out in this house, which was the exact opposite direction than the ships. Meanwhile, the people waiting on the ships were told the emperor had deserted. So I think that he was there was a plot with his nearest and dearest to betray him. So he went to this house, and of course someone tipped him off where he was, and he had gotten this poison from his favorite poisoner, but someone had stolen the poison. So he didn't have the poison. And so he went through, it's very interesting, actually, the story about what he did and the things that he said and so on. But as he heard the hoofbeats approaching, he quoted Homer from the Iliad about, I hear the hoofbeats are approaching. And then he made his famous comment about what an artist the world is losing. And he stabbed himself in the neck, of all things, in the neck. And then his servant had to, finish him off. And so they found him just as he was dying, and the soldier came. They wanted to bind it up so they could, then execute him. But he said, this is your loyalty. And then he died. So he was buried by his faithful old ex-slave mistress and a couple of servants, and then later was put in a very nice family tomb of his family. And that's the tomb that was considered to be haunted in the Middle Ages. And the Pope said that there was an evil spirits of Nero, who was thought by some to be the Antichrist because of his persecution of the Christians. And so the Pope had the tomb torn down, and then they built that church of Maria Popolo right there. Where
now, speaking of Christ and Antichrist, with Christ, of course, the Christians expected him to come back.
Yes.
But what about Nero? I mean, was this cult that said, the emperor is dead, but did he have this mystique about him that made people doubt it?
There was a Nero will return, or Nero isn't dead, quite a cult about it, especially in the East, first of all, I think it was the mysterious circumstances of his death. I mean, people couldn't be sure he really was dead because, his freedmen said he was dead, but was he dead? And nobody had seen the body.
All these conspiracy theories.
He wasn't really dead. Some people said that he had escaped after all. And then you had a series of at least three and maybe more imposters that proclaimed themselves to be Nero and actually got enough of a following. One of them was so sure of himself that when the triremes of the Navy came to where he was, he ordered the captains to come and report to him. And the captains weren't sure. I mean, they had to go back and ask the soldiers. So he had this mystique. The Parthians liked one of the imposters so much and they hated Titus, and they decided that they would actually see if they couldn't recognize this Nero and depose Titus. But apparently these people all looked like Nero. They could sing. And remember, people in the East hadn't seen him. They'd only seen his coin. So you didn't have any people who could identify for sure that this wasn't Nero. But, there are very few rulers that have this cult that they want him to come back. Now, part of it's because, you can think an emperor is really bad, and then you get a worse one that comes along. And I think, like, when Queen Elizabeth I died, people were ready for a change. She had been queen a long time. There were a lot of things about Parliament that she had postponed the showdown with Parliament about who was going to rule. But so, they were looking forward to having a royal family and all that. But then James was such a dud. And then Charles was even worse. So Elizabeth's reputation grew after she died. They wanted her back again. It was seen as the golden age of England. And maybe the same thing happened with Nero. They said, you know, look at these duds we have now. And we, you know, Nero wasn't so bad, and he had a lot of good things. There again, what were the good things that they wanted back about Nero? And he was always popular with the common people. He just wasn't popular with the aristocrats.
And do you think part of it is just that he makes such a good story that if you're colorful the way he was, it's just simply more interesting?
I think so. I think so. I think that in retrospect, the idea of the singing, the cavorting tyrant was really much more interesting than some workaday kind of guy like Vespasian.
Well, he was the end of a dynasty,
yes,
too, wasn't
and
he?
Yes, he was. He was. It was the last of the dynasty started by Augustus. And, you know, every one of those is very colorful, as we've seen in the I, Claudius series. I mean, every one of them.
And Caligula was in Caligula. That mix somewhere.
Yes, Caligula was his uncle. Uh-huh. Because,
quite a family, really.
Family.
One of the most notorious of all Roman, assassinated.
Yes.
And what do you think is the legacy, then, of Nero? How is sort of history different because there was Nero at this point?
Oh, golly. Well, maybe it precludes a stage appearance for rulers. No, I just think that it was the close of an era, and in a way, I don't know if you could duplicate him in any way or if there were any lessons to be learned from him. He certainly did rule the Roman Empire when it was at its height. And he was, of course, he did pursue a rather, you know, sensible foreign policy.
Did subsequent emperors tend to stay home?
I think
get the job done.
Well, probably more, yes. And also, the lesson, though, too, was that the Senate had been, it was so stripped of power, and it was never going to come back again as a republic. I think maybe that was his legacy. He put the nail in the coffin of the republic forever and ever. Nobody could expect the republic after that.
So how stable was Rome after Nero?
Well, they had a real year of terrible upheaval, the year of four emperors after he died. There were four different emperors, each one of them dispatching the other or something. And then it became more stable. And then you got emperors that were just kind of bureaucrats. I mean, they were recruited, a lot of them, from the army or from the provinces. So it became much more stable.
And was there any sort of outcry against the number of executions? And in other words, would you say that Nero was the last example of someone who could get away with murder so easily?
Well, that kind of murder, I think, anyway. But I think the other emperors, there was a lot of bloodletting with them, too.
Were there further assassinations of emperors?
Were there further assassinations? Yeah, there were. There were, but I can't name them right.
Mothers,
now.
Too?
No, I don't know. No, not mothers. Not mothers.
Might have been the low point there
not
that
mothers.
Regard.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing the book that you're going to be writing about Nero. You'll have to be back on with us when that comes out.
I'm excited to tackle these things. I mean,
we'll see how good you can make him.
How good can I make him? That's a real challenge. How good can I make him?
Our guest has been Margaret George. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.